Hello, I'm Renee Vaughan Sutherland, and welcome to Greater Than 11%, a weekly podcast that explores roles and opportunities within the creative industries, with the aim of contributing to increasing diversity across the board, in addition to promoting some awesome women. Episode 48, we're in Birmingham, and I'm joined by author, board game creator, and domestic violence service manager, Shadish Paul. Shadish, witnessing domestic violence in the Southeast Asian community when she moved to Birmingham about 25 years ago, wanted to do something to help. Initially training as a counsellor and doing voluntary work, she has gone on to work for a number of organisations and is currently a domestic violence service manager for a housing and social care association. She's a tireless advocate for educating on the machinations of abuse, grooming, manipulation, control, shame, and weaponised her love of reading as a tool, writing two books, The Perfect Match and The Perfect Dress, to raise awareness of abuse. Chick lit in style, she uses the genre to inform and engage women who may be at risk. She's also written articles for The Guardian, the National Diversity Awards, and published The Budget Cookbook, aiming to help families cope with the rising cost of living. Shadish has also developed an interactive board game, Picking Up the Pieces, which forms part of a course exploring the issues of domestic violence and abuse, its impact on families and communities, and the support services available. And she's soon to release a new game. She is a powerhouse. She's been named as one of the top 10 inspirational British Asian women by Asian Today magazine. She's received the Outstanding Contribution to Society Award from the Asian Business Chamber of Commerce. She was shortlisted for the West Midlands Woman of the Year Award and also shortlisted for the Role Model Award from the National Diversity Awards. And she won the Commitment to the Cause Award at the Asian Achievement Awards. Shadish, I'm a little awestruck. What a joy to welcome you to Greater Than 11%.
Thank you very much. That's an amazing introduction.
It's all yours. So I'm wondering if we can start with you describing a little bit of why you decided to become a fiction author in addition to your role as a domestic violence service manager and how the two are connected.
I mean, as a young person, I wasn't a big reader, but that might have been because of the genre that in school they introduced. And I think probably about 10 years ago, I got into reading and I started reading stuff that I enjoyed, but also reading things. One, I was reading quite dark stuff because it related to my work and it was really fascinating to see how people told other people's stories. But on the other side, I used to read quite a lot of chick lit stuff. So because sometimes when you work in this environment, you need things that help you just to relax because you see a lot of dark things. So these were the two extremes to reading that I had. And then literally I thought to myself one day and I thought, well, wouldn't it be great to write people's stories? And so when I started, literally I just did one Sunday afternoon and I thought, right, I'm going to do this. And I started sort of in the middle by telling somebody's story. And I had quite a few people that I know very close to me who had experienced domestic abuse and didn't really talk about it much. And I think that was just for their own personal reasons. So I wanted to sort of help get those stories out there without breaching sort of confidentiality. But then also for these past 23 years I've worked with so many different women with so many different experiences, and I wanted to start capturing some of those stories and impact, but also give hope to people, because one of the things that we do within my work is about giving hope to people and talking to them about how there is life after that experience, a positive life after those experiences, if they allow us to help them, if they try and help themselves and use some of the tools and things that we give them. So it's really important. So I wanted to try and get though a wider understanding, because one of the things is that it doesn't matter who you are and what field of work you work in. I have even social workers who've experienced abuse and say, I don't know where to go and get help. And you think to yourself, well, you're a social worker, you should know these things. But actually, the people don't, because unless you've engaged in those types of services, you know, the likelihood is that you don't know where to go, who to call. You might be scared about going on the internet, for example, and looking it up in case somebody sees, you know, that you've browsed on a web page. And so I just wanted to write something that was a way of getting a message out. And, you know, it's a story. It's called The Perfect Match. So there's nothing, you know, that describes what the book's about, really, you know, in the title. And that's basically why I started. And then whilst I was writing it, one of my son's teachers was on maternity leave. So I sort of reached out to her and I said, because she was an English teacher, and said, would you read it? Because my English is okay, but I haven't got a degree in English literature or any English language or anything like that. So I said, would you read it for me and just correct it for me if there's any grammatical mistakes and things, which she did, which was great, because she was like, oh, I've got to go back to work, so this is a really good start for me to get back into the swing of things. So that worked out for me. And then when I went to see her, when I went to pick the book back up, she said to me, if you were to take out the rude bits from it, mm-hmm. I could actually show this to my year 11 and year 12 students. I thought, great. But then I realised that it sort of takes away from the story, and because it is an adult story, mm-hmm. and it does talk about the real life experiences of women, so I thought I can't do that to the book, mm-hmm. because it takes the heart and soul out of it. But I had already started another book for younger people, because I'd thought about this, but I'd sort of shelved it for a year or so, mm-hmm. and then I thought, well, okay, well, why don't I pick that back up then and continue working on that, which became The Perfect Dress, and aimed at younger people. And young people, having Twilight and movies like that have come out, kids got back into reading, which I think was slightly, maybe they were drifting away from it. And I found a lot of young people were watching, because they'd watched the movies, or they were reading those books. So I thought it's a great way of raising awareness of the issues of forced marriage, grooming, and abuse to young people, but doing it in a light-hearted way, because I think that's really, really important, that it's age-appropriate, and that if young people read things like that, then maybe they'll learn that there is help out there, you know, just by reading through the lines. I mean, it doesn't really sort of go into a lot of detail, but there's enough information to understand that, yes, this behaviour is not healthy, or yes, there's help for forced marriage, or if somebody treats you like this, it's wrong. There's enough in there for young people to learn, but it's all done in a really light-hearted way.
Yeah, helping them spot it as well, like you're saying. So being aware, like, this is not okay.
Yeah. We think that over the years, through generations, all of these policies have come into place, legislation has changed for the better. You know, there's the Equal Rights Act. We're finding that although, you know, there is all of this legislation, there is a lot more talk about equality, there are still so many women experiencing abuse. So it's important that people know what to do to get help.
And could you give us a bit of an overview? I know you touched lightly on it, but the two books, kind of what the overarching narratives are.
Yeah. So Perfect Match is the first one that I wrote. So that is really about a young woman who goes into a marriage not having had choice, but it's not labelled as a forced marriage. And that's because there are so many women out there that, you know, they're not necessarily abused and forced to go into marriage by the family, but they've grown up thinking, well, my parents are going to decide for me. And so basically the story is about this young woman, and some of the small parts to the storyline are from my own experience. For example, the meeting your prospective partner, things like that, I use my own experiences. But generally it's about a woman who is forced into a marriage, is then abused by her husband. And it's all about how nobody comes to help. She can't talk to people. She feels ashamed that she doesn't want people to know. And then she gets to a point where she can stay there no longer because of the violence, and how she then ends up in a place like a refuge. And again, I can describe it really well because of my experience of working and managing refuge services. And then how she meets lots of other women who have also experienced abuse as well. And then she makes a really good friend whom she moves in with. And then it's the whole journey of how she starts to rebuild her life. And then her story of how she meets somebody who'd also been a victim, but as a child, because I thought that was really important to talk to people about their experiences as a child, because you can still experience abuse in the family environment. And so then she meets this person who she connects with, who has also had their own experiences and the difficulties in building trust and moving forward with that relationship, because there aren't that many Asian authors around, although there are more than there used to be. And I wanted to make sure that this story was a sort of a story from the BME community. And so there are other issues that, you know, the BME community, South Asian community face, like within the culture, like the caste system. So it's got little sort of anecdotal side stories within the book itself. And then The Perfect Dress is basically a Cinderella story, and I wanted to do something that linked in with that because, again, I thought for young people, it's relatable, isn't it? Mm-hmm. But at the same time, I've always seen how, you know, whether it was Cinderella, how she was abused, and I know it's a fairy tale story, but actually, that's what she experienced. And so I sort of wrote it with a twist of her being that stepdaughter who was abused and then was potentially going to be forced into a marriage, and the reasons for that forced marriage come about in the book. But then how she meets somebody, just like the Cinderella story. So to make it easy for young people to read, but then, like I said, also to learn about some of the serious issues as well. And I did use grooming as an element in it because I know it's a massive issue within all communities. So again, just to plant that little seed for a young person who might be reading it so that they can recognise some of those signs and symptoms as to what that sort of relationship might look like.
Wow. What was your process? Like you said, one Sunday afternoon you sat down, you thought, I'm going to start writing, yeah. And then you got your friend to check. But why did you just go, I'm going to write? Like, yeah. You know, how did you come about that and how did you tackle it? Like you said, you didn't study writing.
I mean, it wasn't easy. It took, I think Perfect Match must have taken me all in all about 5 years from when I started. Because I went back, I, you know, rewrote lots of it. I'd print it. I'd sit then, I'd read it, and I'd, you know, write over it, cross things out. And then I joined a couple of online websites where there are lots of people who like to write, but not professional authors, where you can put your sort of first 10 pages of a book on there. And, you know, they read your 10 pages, they give you some critical feedback. But to get yours read, you have to read other people. So, you know, it's like an exchange thing. So you get really good feedback and you sort of learn as you write. And then, yeah, I had a few people read and feedback and things as well. And being a bit of a perfectionist, it's a case of like, you have to get to a point where you think to yourself, actually, you know what, this is good enough. I'm not going to keep making changes to this because otherwise you can go on forever. But it literally did take me about 5 years. And The Perfect Dress sort of was an in-between thing. Mm. It probably took me 2.5 years, I think, to write it. So, and a lot of late nights, sitting up till 2 o'clock in the morning, and when you sort of get into the flow, while you, I shouldn't say this about work, but while you're sitting at work, you get an idea, and then so you quickly record it on your phone, because otherwise you'll forget.
Yeah.
So just things like that, really. Mm. But it's, very long process, I have to say, yeah.
Okay, so I'm wondering if we can go back a little bit and you can tell me about your career journey up until now.
Yeah, I went, after I got married actually, came to Birmingham. I come from a really small town by the name of Letchworth, not much diversity at all. So coming to Birmingham was actually a massive culture shock for me because I moved in with my husband in a very ethnically diverse area. And to be honest, I'd never seen as many brown faces before in my life because it wasn't where I was from. Mm-hmm. After a couple of years, I decided, after I had my first son, decided to go back to college. And I thought about what I wanted to do. And as a youngster, maybe, you know, sort of going into nursing or something like that was an aspiration. So I've always wanted to work with people. But I didn't have those opportunities because I was the eldest in my family. And my dad didn't want me going to college. It was like you get to 16, you do your GCSEs and you're going to get a job because you really all you're going to do is go and get married. Mm. That's what happened. And so I didn't have the opportunity to do that. So after I had my son, I went back to college, but I decided to do counselling. I'd seen some of what was going on. And this is going to sound really funny, but actually as a youngster, I was brought up on Bollywood movies. Mm. And if you've ever watched Bollywood movies, watched one or you watch 100, in those days, every one of them had a level of abuse. There was a rape scene and there was a lot of really negative stuff. So even in a romantic film, there was still a lot of abuse that took place. And from a very, very young age, one thing we did do, my dad, you know, had a load of Bollywood films and we'd watch them every weekend. I grew up being quite angry towards the sort of atrocities against women. You know, some of my favourite movies that I watched over and over again had a level of abuse. Not that they didn't package it in that way. Now I look back and I think, oh my God, you know, this movie was one of my favourite films, but it was about mother-in-law, how she treated her daughter-in-law. Mm. You know, she was physically abusive, tried to poison her and all of these things. And at 7 years old, this was one of my favourite films. But it was because at the end of the movie, how the daughter-in-law builds up the strength to stand up to her mother-in-law. And I think that's what inspired me because I liked that whole people going through adversity but coming out a hero at the end. I went back to college after my son was born, and you know, I went for an interview to do counselling, and I got on the course, and so they said you need to then go and do some voluntary work. And so I just signed up with our local voluntary bureau, and they introduced me to, initially it was a women's aid service, and they said, we can't find anything for you to go and work with Asian women, because I wanted to use my language skills as well. But they said, we found you this, and then I thought, that's fine, I'll do that. You know, I'll work in a refuge with children, that's fine. And then literally within about 4 weeks, they rang me back and they said, we found the perfect voluntary opportunity for you. And they introduced me to a South Asian women's refuge. And basically that's where it started. And then I worked within that in there for about 4 years, and then I left because I had this bug to set up my own business as well at the same time. So I did, and I ran that for about 3 years, as well as do radio work for an Asian radio station. But at the same time, things changed in my home because I had my second son. He was displaying signs of, at the time we didn't know, he had a number of assessments, and over a 2 year period, he was diagnosed with autism. And when you run your own business, you know, it's a 24/7 job, and I felt I couldn't give him the time and commitment if I stayed within the business. At the time, there was opportunities to come back into this field of work, and because of my experience, I managed to get back in. And over the years, I've done a number of different roles. So I've done homeless prevention, I've done project management, and now obviously I'm a service lead, so you know, I help improve services, I help do all the tendering, I do a lot of partnership working. I've even sat in on domestic homicide reviews where women have died, and so I've sat in and been an expert from a BAME perspective to see whether what happened to this woman was a domestic abuse or not, because it's about looking into the background and why maybe she didn't access services and understanding the cultural barriers and things. So I've done things like that. I've always wanted to do more than that, which is where like my games have come from. I know you mentioned before the picking up the pieces. Initially I worked with my company to develop those. It was an idea that I had, and I had a really great relationship with my chief executive at the time, and he was like, I want you to develop it for us. And what I'm launching actually next week is something different. The previous game that I did was for older children, sort of 14 plus. But last year, I again had, it was literally was another Sunday afternoon watching TV with the family, had an idea for a game. So over the course of this last 18 months, I've tested this new idea with schools and parents and teachers. I've amended it and adapted it to, with all the changes and recommendations that they've said. I've used it in like summer camps and things where you've got a lot of children there to get, you know, feedback very quickly from a lot of children. And then I've also, like I said, I've tried it with parents who were not sure whether they wanted their children using it or not. So, you know, I invited the mums to come along and say, well, you, why don't you have a go and tell me what you think? You know, the feedback has been so positive, to a point where, you know, even just on the practice runs, we had mums disclosing historical childhood sexual abuse. We've had children who, where we've tested it in schools, where the teachers have had to say, okay, we need to look into this because maybe they've made comments or given feedback about what they learned. And in their feedback, they've written something that's a bit concerning. And the other thing that the kids have said about this, and so many have said it, is that they think it's fun. Because they're learning, and they're learning not just from me as a facilitator, but from other children, because you play it in your class with the other children. They're enjoying learning about it. And so what I've done is I've developed two different age groups, one for younger children, one for older. And the younger children one is very simple. It's just about feelings, emotions, identifying a trusted adult, looking at some of the case studies and the issues that children might face, like things like internet safety, about how to protect themselves in case somebody tries to do something that's inappropriate. So without making it really scary, hopefully it's about helping them to develop attitudes which are positive, equal across both genders. I've tried to be inclusive as well. So things like where initially I'd put things like, if mummy and daddy are arguing, how can it make children feel? So because there's questions on the board. So after talking to a few people, we changed that because we know that not everybody has a mummy and daddy anymore. Some people have a mummy and a mummy, or a daddy and a daddy, or they may not have parents. They might live with grandparents, or they might be in care. So, you know, we changed it to say parents and carers. So we've tried to be inclusive in that way. So that's for the younger children. We thought if we can start getting children to see each other as equal, understand positive relationships, and that's with their peers and other students, if we can get them to start thinking about those and understand that conditionality in relationships. So I don't want you talking to that person, you know, I'll only be your friend if you don't talk to anybody else and just talk to me, things like that, because those sorts of attitudes later on develop into the conditionality in relationships. So, you know, where we've got older generation, when you get from the teens onwards, people start saying, well, I don't want you going out, or I don't want you dressed like that, or I don't want you talking to that person. That little thing about, you know, not talking to each other when you're young can develop into, as you get older, an abusive relationship. So if we can get children, younger children, talking about that then, and identified those supportive, trusted adults, so they know they can go and talk to them about anything that they're experiencing. Then as they get older, we've got the second game, which looks more at domestic abuse and coercive control, but also things like sharing of indecent images, which is an issue within the younger, sort of the young teens, or understanding what forced marriage is, or honour-based violence is. So it basically includes all of that. But again, it's done so they talk to each other, the students. It's not me standing at the front or a teacher standing at the front lecturing the students on it. They're fully engaged in the conversation. And within the conversation in the game, there are lots of challenging questions which help to break down stereotypes. And so when I've been in a room of children, they're challenging each other. You know, they're talking about whether if, you know, one person takes a potential boyfriend, girlfriend out on a date, does that date owe them something, you know? And there are lots of young people who think, yeah, she does or he does, you know, or does she deserve to be treated in a way because of the way that she's dressed? And those conversations take place. And all we do facilitating the game is to help facilitate the conversation and help challenge. But also the game comes with a guide, which has got a lot of those answers in there. So how to challenge. So if you've got young people who have got this stereotypical view, then how do you challenge back? So that information's in there. And I think with schools now also talking about how, you know, that the budgets are very tight, you know, they can't afford a lot of things, I've developed it in a way that they don't need me to come in and do it. They have the facilitator's guide. As long as they've got some confidence, they should be able to purchase the tool and use it in their school. And you don't have to buy anything again. You've got it. You use it over and over again. And we know children learn through repetitiveness, you know, going over things over and over again. I'm hoping this is going to help start conversations in schools. And hopefully it is fun for young people to play, because there's a competitive element in a sense that they're working through steps on a board. And, you know, whoever gets to the end wins, that type of thing. You know, it's not enough just to say to children, you know, if somebody touches you like this, it's wrong, because that's knowledge. It's good, you know, it's good to give children knowledge, but you only make change through action. And what my game does is says, right, this is wrong, but what are you going to do about it? Who can you talk to? Who can you tell? Who's your trusted adult? So it's about taking action, and I think that's how children and young people can protect themselves.
So amazing that you thought to gamify the process. How did you come up with that? Did you have an aha moment, or was it like over time thinking, how could I address this so that it becomes part of the fabric of someone's kind of upbringing or knowledge?
This game was an aha moment, but initially I think when I first did my other one, which was like 7 years ago, that came over time, and I'd started looking at gamification and what we can do. And we were doing like worksheets and things. A lot of organisations do things like that to make it a bit more creative and child friendly. And then I think I'd seen something online, like a customer service game. And I thought, oh, okay, you know, you could learn about customer service through games and gamification. Well, what if we could learn about domestic abuse in that way? And so I deliver training as well. So I do my own internal training for my organisation that I work for. But also I run a women's organisation outside, and I've set up a community interest company with some friends. And one of the things we do is deliver domestic abuse and child sexual exploitation training. So what I wanted to do was to try and use all of that, literally the whole day's training, try and package it into this game, which is difficult because it has to be appropriate. But yeah, sort of it just sort of worked. Mm. And, you know, I constantly talked to my kids about it. What do you think? You know, we tested it. I told my husband, you know, everybody. So you just sort of trial it and test it and see how it works. Mm-hmm. And, yeah, but the second game was an aha moment, literally sitting watching TV, and it sort of came in my mind. And I thought, oh, what if we do it like this? And that's, like I said, a year to 18 months it's taken until this launch. But it's been a great journey doing it. And I think, you know, we've got it right. I think so.
It's awesome. I do like that Sunday afternoon is your, like, most creative time. It's like all your ideas have come one afternoon. Yeah. It's amazing.
Yeah.
Okay, so as you were kind of a self-taught author and you got your two amazing books out there, plus your cookbook, can you describe what skills you need to be an author?
Oh, God, I think it's just about being a storyteller, you know. I think that's what it is. I think, you know, and you've got to be willing to delve. I think that's what it is. I think, you know, people tell stories and they sort of tell the sort of fluffy bits at the top. And I think to engage people, that's what I found with the books that I read, to engage me, it was, I don't know, voyeuristic is a really strong word, but you've got to really get in there and understand. So if you can visualise in your mind's eye what you're reading, I think that really works for people. And I think, you know, that's, for me, that's what it was. And I had to let guards down as well to write it, because, you know, you think, oh, well, people gonna think that's too much, you know. But I think that, you know, if you're gonna be honest about writing something like this, you've got to be really open to it. And a lot of the victims that I've worked with have been very frank and open about their experiences, very, very traumatic experiences. And I think, and if you try and make it a bit fluffy and sort of, and not put that horrible stuff down, it does them a disservice, because actually they experience this. So I think it's what it is. You've got to let your guard down. I think you've got to be able to tell a story. And funny enough, a lot of people used to say to me, you know, when I talk a lot, and you can probably tell from this podcast, I talk a lot, but people say, oh my God, you're such a storyteller. And people have said that for a long, long time to me. So I think, you know, that's literally all it is. You've got to be able to tell a story. You've got to have time, commitment to it, and understand that, you know, you've got to put hours in, because it honestly takes such a long time. So I would encourage anyone to write, you know, just do it.
And so what skills do you need to be a game creator?
Oh God. So with regards to the game, I mean, I don't know how many companies I talked to, because in my head I knew what I wanted. I literally produced something on a Word document, which looked awful. I drew it on a piece of paper. I then transferred it to a Word document. And then what I did was I contacted one of my son's friends, and she's a graphic designer, and she's got this really creative mind. And within a few weeks, she'd come back to me and said, what do you think? And it was literally, I love it. Following that, then it was like, right, so now I've got to find someone who's going to print it for me. And that's really hard to find people who make games online. I researched loads. I'd researched before as well when I did my first game, and nothing's changed in between 6-7 years ago from the first game to now. So I put a call out on Facebook, you know, and said, I need somebody that can do me some printing, but this is what I need. Because one of the things we had to do was that the game boards had to be very big, because when you're sitting in a classroom and you've got 12 or 16 children around you, you can't have a little playing board. So I needed to make it so it was big, but then to put it into a box, it needed to be cut into pieces, and so that it could slot together when they go to play. So I need to find somebody who could cut it for me. And not all printers do things like that. So anyway, it took me a couple of months, but I found a company who could do the lot for me. So I haven't gone to a professional game company, but I've gone to a printer who's very good, and he can do the lot for me.
So what skills you need are just getting things done. That's what you do.
That's
just
what you
do.
Just
find the way.
You just find a way. Yeah. And I think social media is so helpful. Whereas before, you might not have known who to go to. You might talk to people about it. Now you can put, you know, looking for recommendations on Facebook, on social media, or tweet it. And people come to you and say, well, I could do this for you. I can do that for you. Obviously, you've got to source through it all. But I think it's determination. You've just got to keep going. And I think, you know, if you give up and it's not to say that I never feel like giving up, because I do sometimes, especially when you've got so many different things going on. You know, I do, I get like that, where I think, oh, is it really that good? Is it, you know, is it going to work? I've had a few wobbly moments like that with it. So you've got to have good people around you who encourage you and push you. And, you know, and now, like, just really excited about it. But it is determination you've got and belief in yourself that if you know you what you're doing is right, it doesn't matter what anybody else says. Because there's always people out there who are critical. But, yeah, it's just determination, hard work, long hours. But you can get there.
Amazing. So your primary role is domestic violence service manager.
Yeah.
Can you talk about what's involved in this role?
My role is really diverse. I manage services. So, you know, some of it's what we call the boring stuff, you know, management reports and making sure that the staff are in, we've got the right level of staffing, making sure that people who we work with are getting the right support, and often is offering advice and guidance to the staff. What I found over the years is things have become harder for women. And I say women because that's not because I don't believe men experience abuse. It's just my main role is we work with women and children. But, you know, with a lot of changes in the way that benefits are, you know, sort of assessed and things like that, it's made it very, very difficult for women to make those applications. Housing is a problem. So there's lots of additional issues that we never used to have before. There was more resource before. It's not the same anymore. So I have to support staff. The other part of my role is I attend the forums. I make sure that we feed into policy. The service development side of it is key to my role. For example, we identified some time ago that children who come into refuge often leave their school because it's not safe for them to go back. And then they come into our refuge and then it might be difficult for them to get a school place because the schools locally are all full. Our refuge has very large rooms as well. So we've got women with 3, 4, 5 children. And it's a simple thing, but things like, you know, if you can get a place for one child in one school and then you having to put another child in a different school, you can't be at both schools at, you know, at 9 o'clock in the morning, and the schools won't accept that. So we identified a gap that kids were coming into the refuge, sometimes missing 2, 3, 4 months of education. And statistically, they say that if you miss one term, you miss a year. And that's, you know, it's horrible for a child then, that having to miss that much school time, and then they fall behind, don't they? Another thing we identified is that children sometimes, when they come with their mums, are often very behind in their education. And partly that might be because of, you know, their home and maybe, you know, what's happened, they haven't been going to school. But some of it's about children being so frightened in the home that they're in, they don't have the ability to learn. So they might be going to school, they're sitting there, not focusing or concentrating. And, you know, over time we've studied and we understand that a bit more now about brain function and things like that. But those children were behind, so they weren't meeting milestones. Sometimes mums thought that even they've got learning disabilities because teachers were saying, well, actually, your child's, you know, 7 years old, but at the reading age of a 4-year-old, and mum's thinking, oh my God, my child must have learning needs, I need an assessment. But actually, that's not the case. Children aren't able to learn because their mind is not open to learning because it's elsewhere. And so what we did was we went to a grant-making organisation and, you know, we told them about the problem. And we filled out all the applications and things. So we managed to get funding. And so now we have an education worker and we have a therapeutic worker. So those kids that are missing out now have access to somebody that can help them learn during the day. And for those children who might be struggling, we have like after-school club. So those are sort of things that I do. So I identify where the gaps are and try and improve our services so that those children aren't, you know, falling behind or getting equal access or at least something that helps them to catch up. But that's sort of my role really within my service is doing things like that. And obviously I'm going through tendering, you know, so I sort of lead on things like that. I do the training internally. I'm also the safeguarding lead for children. So anybody who's got any concerns about children, they can come to me and talk to me. But also, I developed the domestic violence policy for staff. For a long time, we've worked with women and children as customers or clients. But we never had a policy for staff. We believe the statistic is 1 in 4 women, and it's probably even more than that. Then when you work in a very, very diverse workforce, there's guaranteed to be some women who are experiencing abuse and coming into work. So it's important for them to have somebody to go to. So I'm named on the policy, so I get people contacting me within the workplace as well and say I'm experiencing this and I don't know what to do. So my role is very, very diverse. And you know, I hope I make a difference to people in general, whether it's the clients I work with or whether it's the staff I work with, but also then obviously, like I said, I've set up this community interest company called Swan, and part of that reason was because women from my own community weren't coming forward, and having done this work for such a long time, of the South Asian community, the Sikh women are the least likely to report. That's what I found. But coming from the community, I know it's an issue. So since we set that up, and actually we have secured some funding for that through the Police Crime Commissioner, we're inundated with calls now from our own community, although it's open to anybody. But because we're women from the same community, people trust us. And so, you know, that's slowly growing as well. But my role is, you know, no 2 days are the same, to be honest. You know, it's, you know, we're often, I'll get pulled into all directions, and this whole creativity thing, often I get called on just to say, have you got any ideas on how we deal with this? So yeah, so that's basically what I do.
So you do such a range of things, and you also, you mentioned before sometimes attending like a homicide, and what you're dealing with every day can be quite harrowing. So how do you manage that? How do you maintain this positive vision that I see in front of me?
I'll never forget the first case I dealt with, and it was, I'm Sikh Punjabi, so I speak Punjabi. This lady was Bengali, and she only spoke Bengali, completely different languages. Some South Asian languages you can sort of figure out, but they're two completely different languages. Police had picked her up from a train track, and she was 8 months pregnant. That was the first case I dealt with, and they'd brought her to the refuge. So somebody had reported they'd seen this woman on the train track. She was there because she didn't want to continue with her life. And I remember, you know, at first what I used to do was go home and cry, you know. If they were hungry, I'd say, oh my God, I need to take some food. I need to take chapati flour in. I need to take rice in, because they were all South Asian women. So it was things like that, and I used to take it in. And you know, it was for a while, it was really scary. I think, oh my God, this is what happens in this world, you know. And I didn't expect to see as much as I did. But I think over time you learn that, you know, your work is really important in helping people to cope and recover, and that's what I focus very much my time on and my energy on, is saying, yes, I know this has all happened, and we help them work through that. But I've learnt as well over time, because I've studied, you know, I'm an NLP practitioner, I've got diploma in life coaching, and so what I did was I went out and I've learnt about these things. I attend like any workshop I can get to around anxiety and depression, I'll go to it. So, you know, everybody has their ups and downs. And I went through a few years ago a difficult time. It wasn't in my personal life, but it was elsewhere. After sort of a few weeks of being really seriously depressed over what had happened, I just thought, no, I can't stay here so low, in such a low place. And so I started reading again. I started listening to audio stuff, audio books around anxiety and depression. And so I started learning a lot, and I introduced it to my children. As well, and that's how I do it. And now, you know, hopefully when I talk to somebody, I can talk them through some of those hints and tips and what's worked for me and for people around me. Like I said, you can learn about anything, but it's about taking action, and you know, that's what makes the difference. And so if you give people the knowledge but then the confidence to do something as well, then it works, and that's what keeps me going. And then obviously, like I said, the chiclets, and you know, I'll go home and put on something that's quite very light-hearted. I can't tell you how many times I've watched White Chicks, for example. You know, I just, yeah, I will. And my kids and my family keep me going. I've got really great relationships with my brother and my sisters, my husband, my children, and you know, that's what it's about, really. It's about having strong people around you who then, when you are feeling a bit rubbish, that you can phone up and say, you know what, I'm feeling like this. And because they're positive people, you know, you can call on them. And vice versa, I'm the same. My sisters will phone me and say, I need to talk to you about something. Because they know that if they talk to me, I'll help them work through it. And I think that is, it's the belief, isn't it, that there's a way. There is a way to work through. Whatever it is, there's a way to get through. You just got to find it.
So when you were writing the books, did you learn anything that you didn't anticipate?
This is a bit, this is going to sound really big-headed, right? But when I wrote paragraphs or pages and I'd go back and read them, I'd actually think to myself, did I really write that? That sounds really good. I was surprised by my own determination. I think when I look back now, and obviously I'm a bit older, and I think back and I think, oh my God, how did I stay up that late at night? You know, but it's that motivation, isn't it? Mm-hmm. Looking back, I think to myself, you know, if I can do that, it's just motivation. Mm-hmm. I've got to have the right motivation, and I can do anything.
Creative energy comes in. Yeah. When you're in your creative flow, you can
go
without sleep. You can keep going. You're completely motivated. Yeah. That's what I find.
Yeah. And I think you're just zoned out. That's why it just flows. And that's why, so when you go back and you're outside of that creative zone, you look back and that's why when I was reading it, I was thinking, oh my God, did I really write that, you know, where did that come from? But it literally is, because it comes from somewhere deep inside and you've just got to hone in on it. Yeah, so I think it was just things like that, really.
And do you think you're going to write another?
Everybody asks me that question. Right now I don't have the time. Yeah. If I did, I probably would. Yeah. But yeah, I do struggle with time, only because I do my daytime job. Then in these last 4 or 5 years, I've set up this community interest company, which is slowly, you know, growing. Mm-hmm. And then obviously this last year has been taken up by the games. and then have to make sure I fit my family into it somewhere. Yeah. After I've done this, and I'm on my launch next week, we have booked a holiday a bit later on. Mm-hmm. It is my 25th wedding anniversary this year as well.
Congratulations.
Thank you very much. So we're going away for that. So I think we need some time together, I think, after this. And then after that, we'll have to see.
But you've got it in you. I can sense that. Yeah. It's just the time factor.
It's time factor. It is time factor.
It's going to be a Sunday afternoon, maybe in 6 months, and you're like, I've got it.
Actually, the idea is there.
Okay.
Yeah, the idea is there. It's just a case of having time to sit down. Yeah, so the idea is there. And I do keep thinking, if I don't do it, somebody else is going to do it. But yeah, at the moment, there is not much time.
Okay. Can I ask, what's been one of the biggest challenges you've faced in your career?
For me, I've probably been my biggest challenge because, you know, I think back and I think, oh, and I know I shouldn't do this because then I have to talk myself out of this. I say in my head, I think, oh my God, if I'd had a degree at that, you know, when I was younger, I could be somewhere else now. You know, I could be doing this, I could be doing that. And actually, you know, and then I tell myself, well, actually, I'm doing a job which a lot of people with degrees do, you know, because actually my drive and my management, my senior management, you know, saw something in me that they helped progress me. So I have to tell myself, no, actually, you know, I'm doing a job that people with degrees do anyway. So I'm probably one of my own, you know, biggest critiques or whatever you call them. And sometimes that stops me from doing other things. I go back and I think about everything I've learnt and tell myself, no, actually, you can't say that to yourself, because actually I think I'm putting myself down. But, you know,
you are, because I've got like a complete confused look on my face.
Yeah.
Everything you've done, everything you've achieved, the massive impact you're having on the community.
Yeah.
Like, I can't believe you're saying that.
Yeah,
actually.
I know. But it's just inside, isn't it? And I think everybody has that little thing. And my mum's like my biggest advocate now. Mm-hmm. Like, when she tells people, she can't wait, every day she phones me and it's really annoying. Like, so what's happening with the game now? What are you doing this? And what are you doing that? Or what's happening with the CIC? You know, and I know, because she goes away and tells people, you know, my daughter's doing this, my daughter's doing that. So she does that. But, you know, at the time when I was 17, 18, and I wanted to do all of those things, I know it was a different time. You know, I was the eldest. So, like, my younger siblings, they did go to university. Mm-hmm. But I guess from my parents' perspective, they were very scared about what might happen to me if I went to uni. And I don't hold it against them, you know, because like I said, I've come back after getting married. I went back to college and things. And you know, I literally last week finished a learning and education level 4 course at college. Mm-hmm. So I will become qualified to train as well. Mm-hmm. Even though I've done it for 5 years, mm-hmm. I thought if I ever did branch out and become a consultant, people will say, well, what qualifies you to teach people? Mm-hmm. So I've gone and done that.
Do you actually sleep?
Yeah, I do. I know, it's really hard. I have done it, and I had my last observation, actually, and it made me feel really good. And again, this is, my head's growing. My son said to me, your head's growing, you know. But my tutor came and observed me do a training session mainly around children and domestic abuse and the impact. Mm. And the one word at the top of the observation was, when she sent it to me, was outstanding. Oh, so that made me feel really good. 2 years ago, I set out with some goals, so a mission, my coaching, the NLP, mm-hmm. and my teaching course, and I've achieved it which is great.
It's amazing.
My barrier is me, I know. But like I said, I have to dampen it a little bit, and I say, no, you can't talk like that about yourself.
Which is great.
Yeah.
And you have achieved so much, so you're clearly able to talk to yourself enough to move forward.
Yeah.
Yeah. Okay, awesome. Can you tell me what advice you'd give someone considering a career in fiction writing or as a side hustle, doing something that's maybe aligned with what they do in another kind of career or job?
I don't know if I can give people advice. I mean, I've done it, and that's what I said earlier. Like, if you want to do it, do it. There are so many options out there now. You don't need a publisher to go out there and push your book for you. So you can go down the old route. And to be honest, I mean, I didn't go down that route either. And I do think when I have time, I am going to send my books off to the respective publishers or literary agents. But you can do it on your own, because social media is such a massive tool. And, you know, you could do an ebook and get it onto like places like Amazon, and, you know, you could self-publish. And there's lots of websites that can help you do that. You know, the world is your oyster, actually. You know, there are so many options now for people who want to write. I would say do it. If you have an aspiration or you have a dream, just do it. You know, at the end of the day, you know, what harm can it cause? And think that you can write and do it. Absolutely, you should.
So I know you've got the release of the game, plus family holiday.
Yeah.
So what else have you got coming up in the next few weeks?
Right, so most of my time, I think, outside of work will be taken up by the game, because we're launching the website for it, and so people will be able to come and purchase it off there. So I think we'll be quite focused with that. Having said that, my CIC, Community Interest Company, the organisation I've set up, we've partnered up with two other organisations, and we're about to launch in August a honour-based violence and forced marriage helpline. That's a West Midlands-wide helpline, and so I guess there's some work in preparation for that as well, so there's quite a lot going on with that. So yeah, it's just a really busy time. And then for the game, I'm hoping this is just the start, really. I have some other ideas about what else we could do for young people to help improve lives and sort of try and promote gender equality and things through gamification. So, but I think I need to focus on the game, get that really launched properly, start getting people talking about it, and then I can look at what other ideas I can come up with.
Amazing. I have so loved talking to you. Like, my cheeks are actually aching. I've been smiling so much. So before I leave today, I'm just wondering if I can ask you two things I ask everyone.
Yeah.
Is there a career or job in the creative industries that you know little about and you'd like to know more about? And then I potentially can get someone on the podcast for that. And secondly, is there a woman that you would like to recommend to come on to Greater Than 1%?
Oh, gosh. Music's always been a passion. I don't know a lot about the music, and I guess film industry as well. Like, you know, it'd be great to know about. Like, I think I tweeted Sanjeev Bhaskar recently, because he does the TV series. I've watched both of them, where he's a police officer, you know. And I've said to him, well, what I tweeted him, I said, why don't you do something around this? And it was around, I think it was honour-based violence or something, or an honour-based killing. And he said, well, why don't you write it? So I don't know how I would ever, if I wrote something.
Oh my God, you have to do that. You'd be perfect.
Yeah, that's what he said. So I thought, well, okay, but what would I do with it? How would I write a script? I mean, so I think that's...
Says the woman who's written two books, for Ernie Harp, who's created two games.
But it's different. It's who do you go to with it? It's that, isn't it? You know, you can do as much as you want, but then you've got to step over that boundary and get it to somebody you can turn it into. You know, and actually, again, my big head thing, one of the feedbacks I had on my perfect dress was, this should be a film. So, but I wouldn't know what to do with that. So I think that's probably an area of work that I really don't know much about, is how to get something that's on paper into a series, or, you know, into a film, or whatever it is. So that's probably an area I know least about. Oh my God, there's so many amazing women out there. I don't know, who would I put forward? I know that there's a lady recently, I met her, her name's Dorinda Bansal. She's just launched her exhibition on South Asian women and cars, and she's a photographer. So that was an amazing project. I thought it was brilliant. So, you know, for women who'd come from India back in the 70s, who, you know, took on this challenge of learning to drive, which is something that in some countries even today that women aren't allowed to do. So, you know, she did this project highlighting that. So she was amazing. Another lady I know, Jags Dougal, she's a woman on her own in a very male-dominated industry. And she works with a lot of music artists and she's got her own media company. She's a quite strong woman to be in an environment which there's a lot of men. And so, yeah, I think she'd be great. I could probably run you off a list, to
be honest. They both sound amazing. Yeah. Excellent. Well, I'll try and get at least one of them on, if not both. Yeah. But yeah. Shadice, thank you so much for your time today. I've so loved speaking to you.
It's great. It's great to be able to talk about my work. I've really enjoyed talking to you as well. Thank you.
Cool. Thanks. Thank you for listening. If you enjoyed, please write a review and rate, as that helps other people find Greater Than 11%. Also, stay subscribed to keep up to date on the weekly releases. This podcast is made possible by the support of Hub, an insight-led content agency based in London. A huge thank you to the producers, Pat Murray and James Haverson. And to our editors, Daniel Clark and Laura Francis. And to Maria Continenza for designing the beautiful artwork.